You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
From Bloomberg News and iHeartRadio, it's The Big Take. I'm Wes Kosova. Today, thousands of people claim they got cancer from one of the world's most popular drugs. In November, we talked about how a small independent lab in Connecticut called Valisure discovered in 2019 that samples of Zantac, the widely used heartburn pill, contained the possible carcinogen NDMA. At first, the company that made the drug, at the time it was called Glaxo, now it goes by GSK, they pushed back against the lab's findings, and so did the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. But in 2020, the FDA pulled Zantac from the market. The agency also requested that all prescription and over-the-counter drugs containing ranitidine, which was the active ingredient in Zantac, be removed from store shelves. A new version of Zantac is back on the market. It's been reformulated, and it's no longer made with ranitidine. It's considered safe to use as directed. But now tens of thousands of people who took the old version of the drug have sued. They claim it gave them cancer, and they allege the company was made aware of potential problems with the drug, but didn't act quickly enough. My colleagues Anna Edney, Susan Burfield, and Jeff Feely dug deep into the claims and counterclaims in these lawsuits for Bloomberg Businessweek. They're here to explain what's at stake and just how complicated it is to try to prove a drug made someone sick. Susan, can you tell us about Zantac and why it was such a big deal?
Zantac was first developed to treat ulcers and then got approved to treat heartburn, and along the way became a billion-dollar drug for Glaxo and the best-selling prescription of all time. So hugely important to the company that developed it, pretty important for a lot of people, millions of people who were taking it. And now, of course, you know, important for people to understand what happened during all those years between development and now.
And one of the reasons this drug became so popular, Anna, as you write in the story, is that it was one of the first drugs that was marketed directly to consumers.
That's right. We see ads all the time now on TV, I think, and we think of those and make fun of them from time to time. And, you know, it wasn't as ubiquitous back then, but Glaxo made sure that it had an enormous sales force combined forces with another company to try to make sure that they were getting the word out about this drug and even went too far sometimes and were reprimanded by the Food and Drug Administration for some of the claims that they tried to make.
And Anna, all this time that this drug was selling in huge amounts and making this company a lot of money, there were indications behind the scenes that there were potential problems with it. Could you describe exactly what was the problem with this drug?
Yes, these indications that there was a problem with the drug started before it was even approved by the Food and Drug Administration. There was some testing that Glaxo did internally that showed that under certain conditions, Zantac, which, you know, before it was approved, was called ranitidine because that's the active ingredient in it. This testing showed that ranitidine could form a probable carcinogen called NDMA.
So how did that happen? Where did the NDMA come from?
So what they found out with Zantac is that ranitidine itself degrades to form NDMA, and this can happen over time while it sits on the shelf. This also can happen in heat and humidity. So maybe when you're transporting the drug and the truck might be have higher temperatures when they're taking it to the drugstore, this can be in your bathroom. You know, these are pretty normal temperatures where it's able to increase the amount of NDMA on the drug. So you don't just have a set amount of NDMA, but it rises over time and with heat. What they have argued is that it would have only been in conditions that just aren't even possible to happen within the human body.
So that at the time the drug is manufactured, it can be just fine. But over time, sitting in your medicine cabinet can develop this probable carcinogen all by itself.
That's right. The NDMA is formed when the drug degrades. The drug has some characteristics that make it susceptible to forming NDMA. What happened is Glaxo looked into this once the news was out there in 2019, and they determined that they don't know exactly what is making it degrade. They don't think there's any sort of regular chemistry process that they can understand of how it gets there.
Probably one of the simplest ways to think about this is just that ranitidine as a molecule is unstable. And so over time, in heat, in humidity, it degrades, and that creates problems that we're seeing now.
And why is NDMA a carcinogen? What does it do?
NDMA was once used in rocket fuel, but essentially, you know, it's not even allowed to be used in any commercial uses anymore. It essentially is only used now to cause cancer in like lab rats, animals that are being used for research. And they call it a probable carcinogen because it's never been tested on humans, but every single animal that has ever been given NDMA, no matter the species, has developed cancer.
And it's not just a cancer, it's a laundry list of cancers, bladder, lung, all sorts of different cancers.
Jeff, how is it that you know everything that you're describing here, the deliberations behind the scenes in the company, how they responded to various signs that there may have been something wrong?
Well, we have access to the actual lawsuits themselves, the complaints. We have access to the pretrial depositions done of the Glaxo officials. We have access to internal documents that were turned over in discovery in some of the lawsuits. So, you know, we got a pretty wide view of what was going on.
We also filed a Freedom of Information request with the FDA. So we also have the minutes of the meeting where a group of outside advisors and FDA staff were talking with Glaxo scientists. At the end of the day, they suggested that the FDA go ahead and approve the drug.
Susan, what did GSK say when you presented them with what you found in your reporting about Zantac?
We sent GSK a pretty detailed memo laying out what we had found, what we had seen in the court documents, what our own reporting showed. They declined to answer any of our specific questions. They did give us a statement that said that there is no scientific consensus about any consistent or reliable evidence that Zantac increases the risk for any type of cancer. So basically, they're saying the science is on their side. They also said that they will defend themselves vigorously against all claims in any litigation.
What does the FDA say about approving ranitidine, which they eventually then had to pull from the market?
Yeah, so the FDA gave us a statement that I'll just summarize. Basically, what they said is that they evaluate drugs according to the, quote, science of the day. And when there's a problem, they'll act quickly to figure out what to do. So I guess, you know, what they're saying is they did the best they could.
And you write that GSK continues to say that ranitidine does not cause cancer, correct?
The way GSK has put it is that there are no consistent signals that Zantac causes cancer. What they mean by that is that there are conflicting studies. You know, nobody has given Zantac to humans and said, let's find out if this causes cancer. You can't do that ethically, but people have looked back in different epidemiological databases and things and tried to figure out if people who took Zantac had a higher risk of cancer. It's true there's no consistent signal that it causes cancer, but there's also no consistent signal that it doesn't cause cancer.
Anna, the last time you were on the show, you were telling us about the small lab called Valisher, and it saw a problem with ranitidine. Can you just remind us what they found?
Yeah, Valisher at the time, so this was in 2019, they are an independent lab. At the time, they were also a pharmacy, and so they were testing all the drugs that came through. And so they happened to be testing some Zantac, some ranitidine, and they saw these super high levels of NDMA. They took that information, they ran more tests, they kept finding NDMA in every single batch that they tested. And so they wrote up that information and they sent it to the Food and Drug Administration as a petition saying, you need to look into this.
Jeff, we should say that the concerns we're talking about here are no longer a problem with the current version of Zantac that's on sale now. Is that right?
Zantac did come back on the market, but ranitidine was taken out of it as the active ingredient, and they replaced it with another one. So you can get Zantac today, but it will not have ranitidine in it.
After the break, the lawsuits over Zantac get underway.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Jeff, it's been a few years since the old version of Zantac that was made with ranitidine was pulled from the market. Now, a lot of people who took that version of the drug claim they got cancer and they're suing. Can you walk us through what's happening?
Sure. So there are two sets of cases, as we have in this country, two separate places where you can sue. In federal court, there were roughly about 50,000 cases filed, and they were all consolidated before a judge in Florida. That judge recently found that the science underlying the claims was flawed and threw those cases out. The plaintiffs, the lawyers for those who took Zantac, are appealing that decision.
So 50,000 people who claimed they were sick sued. Their cases were put together and they were just thrown out. That seems like a fairly sweeping judgment to happen early on in a case. That must have been a little controversial.
It was, and it is. These cases were brought together in what's called a multi-district litigation, or an MDL, and it's where you have a legal issue that gets filed in different federal courts around the country. They are consolidated before one judge for pretrial information exchanges and test trials. One of the pretrial things that are done in all these cases is sort of a check on the science that underlies them. And they have a hearing, and the plaintiffs put forth their experts, and they testify how they came to the conclusions that ranitidine was a possible carcinogen. So it's up to the judge to decide if that science is legitimate enough and the cases can progress. This judge in Florida decided that the science was flawed, that it was not independent enough. It was tied too closely to the litigation to be considered, you know, legitimate independent research.
Despite the fact that these tests that Valisher and others had done showed this probable link and that the FDA itself ordered the drug pulled from the market?
Correct. And she even noted in her decision the irony of throwing these cases out when you have a recalled drug. But she found that the science just did not stand up as far as she's concerned. Now, this is one federal judge, and her decisions are appealed to panels and groups of federal judges who review them. So we'll see what the outcome of that is.
Yeah, and in that statement that GSK gave us, in response to our questions, they talked about that ruling. They noted that it was 341 pages, that the judge had reviewed 13 studies and had concluded, as they do, that there is no scientific consensus about ranitidine and its link to cancer. So this ruling was really great news for GSK, and they, you know, continue to like to refer to it because they feel and hope that it should be the last word.
Did the FDA weigh in on this suit?
They've, you know, said pretty much the same. There's no consistent signal that Zantac causes cancer. And even since the FDA put that statement out, which was originally in June of 2021, there's been more studies, more inconsistent evidence that it causes cancer or it doesn't. It just goes both ways.
They can't really take a position on this. It's not clear. I mean, it's not like asbestos where there's a consensus that, you know, asbestos is a carcinogen. You know, there's just not a consensus yet. But the FDA ordered ranitidine off the market just to make sure. I mean, you can't, if there is a possibility that this stuff is causing cancer, you don't want it widely distributed.
Jeff, you described that one federal case that you said there is another batch of cases going?
There's been 70,000 cases filed. Most of them now are in Delaware, state court in Delaware. That is because that's where all of these companies' U.S. operations are incorporated. The deal with these is that the states have a different standard for judging the legitimacy of science than the federal courts. And so it's more likely that more of these cases are going to make it to trial, that the judge in Delaware, and cases are also filed in California, Pennsylvania.
And these are all individual. They haven't been all put together.
That is correct. These are all, again, all individual personal injury cases. That's right.
Jeff, what are all of these tens of thousands of plaintiffs asking for?
First of all civil lawsuits are about money. So they're asking for damages for their injuries. They want to be reimbursed for their medical costs, for the pain and suffering of the cancer treatments. You know, God forbid the person who took Zantac has died. His family wants compensation for the loss of that person, loss of his income. So it's always about money.
Susan, even if a drug is thought to be a possible carcinogen, it's still very difficult, I imagine, for any individual person to claim that he or she got cancer from that drug, because cancer can come from a lot of different things.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, for all of these cases and in almost every kind of cancer, I think, except, you know, as Jeff said, asbestos, tobacco, you know, the cancer develops years after you've either, you know, been exposed or have been ingesting something that's harmful. And to be able to make that connection can be complicated. And that's, I think, what the FDA's statement is suggesting, you know, about consistent signals. You know, you can say, as Anna did, there's not signals that it always does, but there's not signals that it doesn't.
Jeff, you write in the story that in other similar pharmaceutical cases, the companies have often settled rather than risk having so many suits that could wind up with judgments against them. Do you think it's likely that the company is going to want to settle these cases rather than bring them all to trial?
I think there's a strong possibility that there will be a settlement at some point. It takes a while for these things to move into that posture. The companies and the plaintiffs want to test the strengths of their claims. And so they have test trials. They have early trials. After you have a number of these things, and some test trial periods last for 20 cases, others for 5 cases, then the parties come together and try to come up with some sort of reasonable accommodation that is acceptable to both sides, and it's always about the money.
And as someone who covers the pharmaceutical companies all the time and knows them well, what are you looking for in these cases? What do you think is the most relevant thing that we should all be taking away from this?
The Food and Drug Administration, what about our regulatory body that's supposed to be protecting us from dangerous drugs? They don't have a lot of resources to look into whether a drug that's still on the market is safe. I think that leaves things up to the courts to decide. It leaves it up to juries to be the last line of defense for anyone who may have been harmed by a pharmaceutical product. And what I'm looking for here is I'm curious to see, you know, if these should get to a jury trial, how regular Americans feel about that.
Anna Edney, Susan Burfield, Jeff Feely, thanks for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
No problem.
When we come back, how drug makers can spot potential hazards in their products.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
What should companies do then to ensure their products are safe, both at the time they're made and after they've sat for months or years in your medicine chest? Dr. Jaap Venema can answer that question. He's the chief science officer at U.S. Pharmacopeia, and he's extensively studied the dangers of probable carcinogens called nitrosamines. One of those nitrosamines is NDMA, which we've been talking about today and is at the center of the legal dispute over the old version of Zantac. He joins me to explain how his organization is setting standards to protect against the spread of nitrosamines in drugs. Jaap, can you tell us first, what does U.S. Pharmacopeia do?
Yes, U.S. Pharmacopeia is an organization that is about 200 years old, and our mission is to improve global health. And we do this primarily by setting standards for medicines, for biologics, dietary supplements, food ingredients, and healthcare, and related programs.
And Jaap, can you explain exactly what are nitrosamines?
So nitrosamines are naturally occurring compounds that are present, are ubiquitous in nature around us, in drug compounds, also in food and other areas. So that's why they're important.
And you say they're in nature. Where are they just naturally found?
So nitrosamines can be formed by a variety of chemical processes. I won't go into the detail, but nitrosamine chemistry is in principle very straightforward and can be formed through a variety of processes. By chemicals reacting, they can form naturally, they can form during chemical synthesis, they can form during certain degradation processes.
And the reason we're talking about them is because they are also possible carcinogens?
Yes. So they have been shown to be mutagenic, so they can cause mutations in your DNA, and they are listed as probable or likely carcinogens in mammals, including humans.
Nitrosamines have been found in quite a few of the most widely used pharmaceuticals, drugs that a lot of us are familiar with. Can you talk a little bit about which drugs that they've been found in and what's happened since that discovery?
So it started with the discovery of nitrosamines in valsartan, which is a class of products that are used to treat blood pressure. So very widely used, and that led to recalls and investigations into the cause of the presence of nitrosamines. That's what started this about 3.5 years ago. Since then, nitrosamines have also been found in other very widely used drugs, including drugs to treat diabetes, tuberculosis infection, as well as gastric acid. So it's been found in a number of drugs that are used many, many times by people all over the world, including the United States.
Now, how are these nitrosamines introduced into drugs? Because clearly manufacturers don't want them there. How do they get into drugs?
So that's actually one of the concerns. So they are, and it's now been established, that they can be introduced into drugs by a variety of reasons. One is through the chemical synthesis route that is used to produce the drugs, to make them. It's also been shown that through degradation, in the case of ranitidine, which is the anti-gastric acid medicine, that through degradation and by reacting with itself, nitrosamines can be formed. A third way that it's been shown to be introduced through interaction with the drug itself, with the packaging and what we call excipients, which are substances used to stabilize and manufacture the medicine. So it's been shown to occur in drugs through a variety of methods.
And because of the widespread sort of exposure to the public of what happened with ranitidine, there's more attention being paid to nitrosamines. What are pharmaceutical companies doing? What is your organization, U.S. Pharmacopeia, doing to try to stop the spread of nitrosamines in pharmaceuticals?
Yeah, there's a lot going on. First, maybe it's good to mention that the very fact that these are being found and discovered and monitored, while, of course, reason for concern, it's also a sign that the system is working because we need to know what's going on. So I think that's the first thing I'd like to say. So since a couple of years, there's a widespread collaboration between the regulatory authorities who are responsible for the safety and the quality of medicine, the manufacturers and other science organizations, including U.S. Pharmacopeia, to try and figure out how we can mitigate and how we can reduce and remove the presence of nitrosamines in drugs. So there are three things going on. First is we have to understand which drugs are at risk of forming or containing nitrosamines. That's the very first thing. The second piece is we need a better understanding of how mutagenic or carcinogenic these are. They're not all carcinogenic. They're not all mutagenic. So it's very important to have more information as to what they do. And then the third piece, very importantly, is to discover and to develop methods to actually detect them and to detect them in a way that detects them in very low quantities to make sure that we have a good handle on their presence. So these are the three buckets that we're all collaborating on. I would say USP is primarily involved in developing the methods and the standards that are necessary to analyze and to discover all of these different nitrosamines.
USP participated in a study that found potentially 41% of active ingredients in pharmaceuticals could have nitrosamines in them. How concerned should we be that nitrosamines and other potential carcinogens are in the drugs that we take?
So do not be concerned to the point that you should consider stop using drugs because of this, because that's very important. That's always the guidance before making any decision talk to your doctor and make the right decision. That's also in line with what regulatory authorities are saying. So this is a theoretical assessment of looking at all the different chemical structures of the drugs on the market and looking for the potential, with the emphasis on potential, to develop them. There are a lot of other factors that go into whether or not they actually will form. Chemical conditions, storage conditions, temperatures, all of these things are important. So I don't want any of you to be alarmed by, oh, 2 out of 5 drugs are now do contain nitrosamines. That is not the case. It is part of the network, of the fabric that we are contributing to really help advance the science and knowledge about these compounds. That's what it is. One thing I'm really excited about and I'd like to share is the nitrosamine exchange that we set up about 2 years ago. So that was literally an online community where scientists, regulators, healthcare professionals come together to discuss and find potential solutions. And in fact, the article that you referred to that we discussed was actually a direct result of that. So we're proud that we are adding our contribution. We, of course, do not have the silver bullet. Nobody has the silver bullet, but it's very important that all of us contribute to this. And that's what we're proud of to do, in addition to the work that we're doing on providing physical standards and methods to allow manufacturers and regulators to actually test for these compounds in a validated and regulated way.
Jaap Venema, thanks for speaking with me today.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
You can read more reporting from Anna Edney, Susan Burfield, and Jeff Feely at Bloomberg.com. Thanks for listening to us here at The Big Take. It's a daily podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartRadio. For more shows from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen. And we'd love to hear from you. Email us questions or comments to bigtake@bloomberg.net. The supervising producer of The Big Take is Vicky Vergolina. Our senior producer is Catherine Fink. Our producers are Michael Falero and Mo Barrow, with additional production assistance from Sam Gebauer. Rafael Amsili is our engineer. Our original music was composed by Leo Sidran. I'm Wes Kosova. We'll be back tomorrow with another Big Take.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.